Hello, this is Josh Carr at The Real Angle, and today we are speaking with Ian Formigli at CrowdStreet, Chief Investment Officer. Ian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Josh. Thanks for having me on the show.
Good. Thank you for joining. It's always a pleasure to talk about new and cutting-edge technologies, even though I think you guys have been around for a bit, so I don't know if I should call you cutting edge anymore. So let's talk a little bit. CrowdStreet, and by the way, before we get into it, I always like to tell everyone, if you want to check out the website, it's crowdstreet.com. I always like to put that out there because invariably someone emails me to say, where are these people? So let's start with the basics. What does CrowdStreet do?
At its core, CrowdStreet is an online platform for individuals to invest in commercial real estate projects across the country. In essence, they join, they create an account, they start getting educated, they get introduced to different operators and developers, and ultimately look for, you know, private equity real estate investments that can take the form of multiple different asset classes, multiple different geographies, and business plans that stretch from 2 to 3 years to over 10 years if it's an opportunity zone, and everywhere in between.
And your role, not you personally, but CrowdStreet's role is essentially, are you taking their money, investing on their behalf? Are you acting as a brokerage type model? Like what does your firm do in between the developer on one side of the room and the investor on the other side?
Yeah, that's a good question because the answer is kind of both. Okay. CrowdStreet has one primary platform, but then a subsidiary platform underneath that serves it. So to start, the primary platform is a broker dealer platform, which is called CrowdStreet Capital. That is the marketplace. So in essence, all of the deals that come onto the CrowdStreet marketplace are running through a registered broker dealer, which is, you know, CrowdStreet Capital. But then within that, you know, over the course of years, and that totality of real estate has looked like over 800 deals, of which about $4.3 billion of equity has been invested through the platform. You know, in over 40 states of project location. Now, within that, though, there is also CrowdStreet has a registered investment advisor, which is called CrowdStreet Advisors. And that has two types of advisory clients within it. It either has a private client group, which are individuals who deposit funds and have an advisor and invest into individual deals on the marketplace. Or we also have a series of funds. And so CrowdStreet does form and manage funds on behalf of individual investors and essentially kind of offers that kind of like that duality of for investors who want to do it themselves, pick and choose. They create a brokerage account and they go into the marketplace and invest individually. And for those who want help, they can get an advisor, or for those who say, I want to kind of buy the index, so to speak. I want to invest in a vehicle, not an actual individual deal. Then they go into one of the multiple investment strategies that we've offered through our funds over the years, which the advisor debuted. So while the marketplace debuted in 2014 and then officially transitioned to a broker-dealer marketplace in last year officially, the registered investment advisor kicked off in late 2018 and really got going in 2019.
And I mean, and I, you know, without getting to specific numbers, obviously, because I realize there's also secret sauce on your side, so to speak. Are you seeing more growth in the investment advisor side right now or more growth in the broker dealer side?
You know, in 2023, I would say there wasn't a lot of growth in the investment vehicle side. We did a couple few vehicles. But also 23 was a down year overall. So we saw, you know,
it was 23
on a percentage basis, probably still similar, but let's put it this way in that aggregate, the total AUM is roughly about $500 million in the RIA, versus about $4.3 billion that's come through the platform total. So you basically deduct that investment volume out of the RIA to kind of get to like what's marketplace only. So still overall, I mean, the marketplace, the broker dealer and the individual brokerage account still drive the platform for the most part. But as we've grown, there's definitely a number of investors who've said, this is interesting, but I'm not an early adopter type of, you know, individual picker, you know, stock picker type of investor.
Sure,
So it's so that we've kind of seen this parting of the path of the different investors over time.
Right. Different people want different things. I mean, some people want to go into a fund and some people are like, no, I want to own a piece of that shopping center in the Southwest, which makes all the sense in the world. No, it's interesting to me because, I mean, I've watched your platform grow because I've been kicking around for a while. And, you know, I remember at the beginning when a lot of the online platform stuff started, there were a lot of entrants into the market. It seemed like everybody and his brother was like, hey, I can put up a website. And now it's obviously winnowed down to a few major players, not that there aren't some smaller ones. So you guys survived, which is awesome, and you thrived. Yeah, I mean, why do you think that was? Because there were so many players that entered this market originally, you know, a decade and change ago when this all started.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a lot of answers underlying that. A couple that stand out were one, we knew that for years we had to navigate a new market, meaning that in any type of new market in the early years, you had to be completely cognizant of that you were fighting adverse selection on a daily basis.
Right.
And so we were thoughtful about that. I think perhaps relative to some platforms that came and went, maybe more thoughtful than others, but we had to start from the beginning of saying, we're not going to do a deal for the sake of doing a deal. We're going to be very thoughtful on what we want to do and try to find the right fit with groups to do it. Certainly not perfect in that regard. You know, we made more than our fair share of mistakes, I would say, along the way.
It's investing. Things go wrong. That's life. Right. Sure.
We were trailblazing in a new industry. I'd say the other thing also was the structure of our marketplace, in that if there was one common thread at the beginning, if I go back to the 2014 period was when there was, you know, a lot of platforms starting and the industry was brand new. One thing that we noticed was that there was a propensity for platforms to syndicate at the platform level itself. And what I mean by that, right, is that if you were investing in the project, you were actually investing into an entity that was created and managed by the platform. And then that the aggregate sum of those dollars that were raised were then contributed, you know, lump sum into a project. What we strategically decided back in the early days was, you know, hey, we were a new nascent platform. We were trying to jump up in terms of working with, you know, the best, you know, as to say what we could see is what we thought were credible operators and developers out there.
Sure. Sure.
But we made that strategic decision to say in these early years, we are not going to create our own entities and then fund lump sum into a project. We're going to allow investors to invest directly into an entity that is managed by the operator or developer itself. And so we were seeking to avoid at that time and pass on the mitigation of a risk to the investors was, hey, look, commercial real estate, private equity, it's risky investments overall. One risk you don't need in 2014 or 2015 is platform risk.
Is you guys getting in the middle of it, right? So basically,
if the platform goes away, what happens, right?
Right.
So we made the decision to say, if the platform were to go away, what happens is certainly a major inconvenience for the investors, because we would cease to exist, and therefore you wouldn't have that experience through the CrowdStreet platform. But your investment into the project would actually remain intact.
Just to get back to the broker-dealer model, if I buy a stock in GE and then my broker ceases to exist, I still own the share in GE. I mean, maybe I got a deal of getting the paperwork and blah, 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 because now I got to move my brokerage account, but my shares don't go away. So at the beginning, basically you were saying, look, we're acting as a broker. We're facilitating these relationships. You're taking a fee, obviously, because, you know, it's a service, but you're not jumping in and then saying, and we get a piece of the deal and this sort of thing, you know, because that was, as someone who's been on the money raising side, the other side of this conversation, that is to say, raising money for my projects, it was weird because at the beginning I talked to some entities that did what you guys did, and they'd be like, well, we'd find you money. And I'm like, great. And then they'd be like, and we'll invest with you and we'll manage all the people on our side, and you'll never have any, you'll just get a check from us, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was strange, you know, because I was used to the broker dealer model where you pay someone a fee and they go and find you money, and, you know, it's cleaner. It's easier to understand, if nothing else. Yeah. It's just more brokerage. Cool.
Comment on that. You go to the next one. So the management aspect of that. So then part of what also we designed through the marketplace was that we needed an online, relatively scalable investor experience. And that there were, if it worked, there were ultimately going to be hundreds of investors in a single project, right? That was our vision back at 2014. We got there. It took us probably 4 or 5 years to actually get to that level of scale per investment. Sure. But we said, in an offline world, 100, 200, 500, we've actually had upwards of almost 1,000 investors in a single project. So that looks like daunting at a minimum to an offline operator developer. I said, what? Yeah. Like that many investors, literally. And we said, you have to remember, this is online. They're investing at smaller increments than they might on average coming through, a friends and family type syndication. And right. that ultimately, if you can deliver a consistent experience through quarterly reports, timely accounting, essentially just project updates and execution of the strategy, uploading information regarding distributions and the like, that you can take, essentially you could have 30 or 40 investors make it feel like one or two in the offline environment, right? Because they will be low touch if you're proactive and if we're communicating through them, through a platform. So that was kind of like the last piece that we said we had to figure out how to get that reasonably right. Again, less than perfect for sure. But that's what enabled us to get to hundreds of investors in a given deal.
No, it's interesting. I mean, the most I've ever done in a traditional investment structure was 22 people, which, is a lot. If you actually have 22 human beings that you have to interact with, it's a lot of just sending documents around and it's aggravating as heck. So yeah, no, I definitely see the benefit of technology in that way. Now, just for people to understand, let's talk about what crowdfunding is and how that ties in with this whole conversation. Because crowdfunding, I think, is a large part of this conversation.
Yeah. To begin with, one thing is to understand the distinction between what is true crowdfunding, which is there's a regulation crowdfunding part right. of the 506, and so forth. And that really what we adopted is, 506 regulation 506 syndication at scale through 506, basically through 506C, right? Okay. And then there's a B, there's a type B.
There's different levels. Yeah, yeah.
506B, we were going to 506C. So we were doing online Reg D syndication.
Okay.
That would enable up to 2,000, give or take, individuals into one entity. They would all have to be verified as accredited in order to do that. There's no, sure.
Reg D. Okay. Yeah.
Right. Even in a Reg D 506B, there's a little bit of a carve out for a certain number of unaccredited investors.
Right? Yeah, sophisticated or whatever it is. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
506C is 100% accredited and verified. And so solving to the verification part, in the early days, we're like, well, what does that really mean? And then when you looked in the regs, they said, well, the operator developer had to take quote unquote reasonable steps to verify accreditation. And that ultimately gravitated towards a letter. On the letterhead of a financial advisor, an accountant, an attorney, a third party who knew that investor and could attest to their status as an accredited investor. So we created a process for folding that into our platform, getting that done through a third party if necessary, or enabling investors to upload that into their account. So that was critical to, creating the 506 structure. But then from there, it is a crowd in the sense that it is a large number of individuals coming together, but it is high net worth accredited individual investors just syndicating at scale. So again, spent a lot of years talking, when we go to conferences and panels, it was really the fact that technically we're not crowdfunding, but we are, we fit into the broader sphere, but really we're just massively scaled syndication.
Yeah, you're as you said, you're huge Reg D. You're not a crowdfunding, the Jobs Act or whatever it was. That's right. It's all a different part of the regs.
Reg CF was like true crowdfunding portals, and right. we were definitely not that. So it was just even helping investors understand that we have a label, we get it, we fit into a space, but we actually are not. We don't fit the definition of crowdfunding.
Well, look, I mean, this, in all fairness, I mean, you're not alone. And by that, I mean, I always enjoy like throwing out, because I've been teaching for years, I always like to throw out the term. I say, so what is private equity? like, let's define private equity. And, you know, private equity is a very large world. You know, I mean, it could be traditional. We take public companies private. It can be we're three guys in a room who just buy real estate. I mean, the word, you know, it's the same problem. It's a term that's so broad. It's almost, I don't want to say meaningless, but it's so broad that it just encompasses a lot of different kinds of things. So with your investors, if you were to say from an interest standpoint, what sells best from a brokerage standpoint, or the investment advisor, from a brokerage standpoint, what sells best on your platform? Is it development deals? Is it stuff in a particular region? Is it a product type? Where do you see the love, and where do you see things that to you, just as an individual, you, Ian, think make sense, but investors just don't get excited by?
Sure. So to start with, you know, what do we see that we like and, you know, we see investors gravitate towards? First, product type. Everything that we've ever done throughout our history is 50% multifamily.
Okay.
You know, we think for, you know, it's obviously a product type that has made sense to us for, and I come out of even a background in multifamily syndication. So I have even a personal penchant for like why invest in multifamily. But it also resonates with private individual investors from the standpoint of it's usually more approachable, right? It's a little bit easier to understand.
Sure.
All of us have probably lived in an apartment at some point in our life. So like we have some connectivity to it. Right. You know, at maybe like when we're a lot younger, but like, again, like the fundamental reason, and then also just like the idea that everybody does need a place to sleep at the end of the day. So, sure. You know, unless for unfortunate people we're houseless, but the idea being
You can wrap your brain around, I pay rent, I get an apartment.
Housing stock, you know, and then we look at the bigger demographics, you know, we're still relatively undersupplied on, you know, individual dwelling units in the United States and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, so for starters, it's just rental housing is something that's approachable. Also keep in mind that a lot of investors, even on the platform, they might be trading out of individual rental homes now trying to go passive to get into multifamily. That's another thing that we see was relatively common on the platform. Multifamily has just made sense.
I want to say just in response to what you just said, what's interesting to me about that is coming into this as someone who doesn't know your business, at least not obviously as well as you do, is the idea that someone would go from active to passive. I always thought of you guys more as, hey, you're giving someone diversification out of stocks and bonds. But what I'm hearing is, it's also active real estate people who, for one reason or another, say, I want to sit on a beach and just have someone else do this for me. So that's interesting to me. That's interesting.
Definitely the case. You know, for a lot of years, we saw a lot of adoption by single family rental owners. I would say that when we did see that adoption, the two things that we saw in common were, one, they'd owned them for a number of years. And so there was, you know, they kind of had seasoned them. There was equity to take off the table, so to speak. Then two, they were interested in transitioning. Yeah, they were kind of done with the active management part, like kind of that adage of like, you know, I don't want to deal with, you know, clogged up toilets anymore. And then the third critical component was trying to actually transition equity gains into passive cash flow. A lot of us have known, who I've personally owned single family rentals myself, like, you know, unless you're unlevered, it's difficult to actually cash flow a home, rental home. The rent to relative to mortgages, and then you think about things
you're paying down the debt, but you're not generating cash flow. Yeah,
you can cover your debt, but it's not something to earn a yield with. So if you take an investor who says, "Hey, I've owned three houses for a number of years, they've appreciated substantially. I think I'm now sitting on a lot of equity. I'd like to turn that equity into some, you know, a 5-6% kind of annual targeted yield while I still own private equity." You saw a lot of that coming to the platform over the years.
Interesting. Okay, so just getting off my tangent that I pushed you onto. So where is there not love? If the love is for multifamily, and that I all get, and that's great, where is there not love, which maybe surprises you, that you think that maybe there should be more love?
I would say what we've experienced on our platform is a lot of the investors who've come over the years have come for statistic, you know, I say like, well, on average, kind of on a statistical basis, coming for what we would see is like, you know, market beating returns. So this would be an avenue that they would look for, you know, anything that would look like kind of like high core plus, but really more value add, opportunistic, trending into development. That had been something that I think a lot of the early adopters came for. You know, as we've grown and scaled, we've also kind of felt like, hey, you know, good cash flowing real estate, not necessarily looking to beat the market, but looking to diversify the market, kind of like sure. push the efficient frontier, so to speak. That makes a lot of sense to us, but is harder to communicate to the investors to say, look, this you might actually target returns here that are more in line with the S&P, but you're going to get there in a much different way. And that in and of itself is valuable versus someone who just says, I just fundamentally want to beat the S&P by 400 to 500 basis points here and take risk to do it.
Got it. Yeah, no, and that's not dissimilar to things I've heard about kind of entities that do what you do, is that people still seem to be very passionate about, they want the higher yield thing rather than just simply, it's like we all understand diversification is good, but it feels like we all understand it's good for other people. You know, like, we learn it. We're like, yeah, that sounds great, but I want to make 80%. Like, you know, like I want to make $1 zillion. Now, what about, and I always like to ask these sorts of things. What about weird product types? What about things like, you know, amusement parks, cannabis dispensaries? Are there certain products that you just are like, no, that's just too weird. That's too wacky. It's just not something that's going to fit.
Yeah, when it goes super niche, it doesn't fit. So the amusement park idea that has approached us over the years, we've never
done. Really? It. Okay, I just guessed that. I just threw that one out for fun.
Or like water park developments, like you trust sure. us, we've seen everything under the sun.
No, I'm sure you have. I love a water park. I didn't have any insight there. I was just throwing it out for funsies, if you will.
If we say niche on our platform, we're thinking self-storage, for example.
Got right? it. Like, okay.
You know, things along that nature. There actually have been cannabis projects on our platform in its history. No longer, as a regulated broker-dealer, cannabis is not an eligible product type on our platform anymore.
Makes sense. Okay. I did not know that, but good to know. Okay.
FINRA regulated broker dealers are not going to pursue cannabis projects, right? So that's just, that's an off, good to know. That's a restraint. But there have been a couple over the years, you know, but typically that we'd say is that, you know, we'll look at, there's definitely types of, you know, like I said, when it comes to self storage or other types of niche products, you know, smaller medical office buildings and things like that. I mean, there's ability for us to go in and do, you know, interesting projects where we think that there's a fit. And then ultimately, you know, again, if we think the business plan makes sense, there's a fit, we think that there's a connection between that and, you know, individual private investors to go syndicate, you know, we'll look at a host of different projects.
Got it. And then here's a question. I mean, the investor side, finding investors, I imagine that's your typical sales cycle. That much I kind of have a sense for. How do you are you finding operators? Are they finding you? What's that process look like? And then, like, is there a vetting phase? Like, how do you, what's that look like as far as bringing operators on? Because you got to bring an operator onto the platform before the operator is even like, right. I imagine there's work that happens before the guy just shows up and says, give me a bag of money. So like, what happens in that process? Yeah.
So first, I'll kind of walk you through the evolution and then talk through what sponsor screening looks like today. So sure. The evolution was in the early days, when we were brand new, there was a lot of inbound traffic, right? There was just a lot of people that were reaching out, exploring it, wanting to understand it. Just a lot of questions. What is this?
Sure.
You know, should I be looking at this, et cetera? So, and that really was, like I said, during that period of adverse selection, you get everything coming at you. And so you really had to sift through to understand, you know, which groups were real and so forth. Over time, you know, just like anything, we've been live as a marketplace coming up in April, it'll be a decade. So we went live in April of 2014. So we've been a part of the commercial real estate industry over that time frame. And so just like anything else, right, you start to show up at the same industry conferences. You know, the co-founder and myself, we're members of the Urban Land Institute. We're members of product councils.
ULI is a great organization. Shout out to ULI, the great organization.
Good stuff. ULI. Love the thought leadership there. And so just like anything else, you know, you incrementally become an established player within the industry. And sure. For those of us in the commercial real estate industry, we do understand that's kind of like 1 to 2 degrees of separation out there, right? There's only so many, good groups that are in a year in, year out basis.
Sure.
So then we gravitated towards also developing. We have a capital markets team. So we have a, team of individuals that are staffed around the country, and they're out there hunting what we would say is kind of our ideal client profile, right? We've determined criteria that we think makes for a good sponsor investor relationship, so those sponsors that we think are out there that we think would make sense for the platform, that we would love to get access to their deal flow. We are knocking on their doors day in, day out. The quote unquote sales cycle on those types of relationships go from months to like multiple years.
Sure.
But over time you get there, and then you start developing, a number of relationships. Like I said, we've done over 800 deals now. There's probably
a lot.
Upwards of 300 relationships, just in the platform that have been there itself. And then there's the next layer of relationships that we haven't necessarily done a deal with, but we've gotten to know. That's turned into obviously a lot of referrals over those years. So now, sure. We've got multi-year relationships with some existing sponsors that have turned into 3, 4, 5 additional relationships through direct referrals as those sponsors have had good experiences. And, and then again, ultimately, really what we're sorting down to is this idea that we represent a different type of channel for equity, right? Predominantly equity. There's some debt on the platform, but it's predominantly
equity. Yeah.
And that really is that is an online, direct to high net worth retail investor type channel. And a lot of groups don't know how to do that. A lot of groups have no interest in doing that. So it's really sorting out, who does this make sense for? Like, why would it make sense? And there's different reasons why it would make sense. And then the last thing is that if it makes sense, does this operator developer really care about it, from a long-term perspective? I mean, yes, it is an equity solution, but at the end of the day, it's really a relationship solution, right? It's a trust-based platform at the end of the day. So does that operator developer really want to come into an online arena like the CrowdStreet Marketplace and develop investor trust over a long period of time? If the answer is yes, a lot of times then we can figure out getting the deal flow. So that's kind of like the evolution that these days that it comes. So you meet them through conferences, you meet them through referrals, you meet them through, sometimes they show up on your front doorstep, that type of stuff. Today, so again, now when we think about screening a sponsor, there's really three types of screening processes that get bolted together to determine whether or not a sponsor is eligible for the CrowdStreet Marketplace. The first is what we say is background sponsor screening itself. They submit applications, they have to tell us information about themselves, the partnership, the entity,
right,
all that. Use Thomson Reuters, we have to kind of dig in, make sure that that what we're being told is actually, we can authenticate.
Checks out.
No skeletons in the closet, so to speak, and all that kind of stuff. That will take some time to get through. If we get into, yes, let's move on to the next phase, then we get into operational due diligence. Operational due diligence is really more that now that we've authenticated, we believe, okay, you've checked a process to say, You reach the criteria of what a CrowdStreet sponsor looks like. Now we actually have to talk about the reporting requirements and performance, overall long-term performance requirements that are required, the quarterly reports, the K-1s and so forth. So, and right, even now that we have an RIA and we have the ability to potentially invest into a project out of a fund, there's different levels of criteria that are even there. They step up. We have, thematic fund criteria. Those are our private 3C1, 3C7 funds. We also have a publicly registered REIT, right? We have a 40 Act REIT. That is a whole different level of reporting requirement, right? So for those of us who know the industry, right?
I was on the board of a publicly traded REIT for 5 years. So exactly. Been there. It's
REIT reporting standards are difficult. So we have to then educate sponsors at each step of the way to say, there's one level of operating requirement to go into the marketplace, a stepped up level to meet, basic fund requirements, and then a whole nother level if you're actually going to talk about getting allocation out of our 40 Act REIT. So there's the operational due diligence. And then the final part is the deal screening due diligence. Well, then we say, if we can get through steps 1 and 2, now we can actually get into a deal.
Now we can actually know what you're working on.
Now we can actually look at a deal and understand determine whether or not we think that, you know, what the sponsor is telling us checks out, if we think it's achievable, right? We're looking for that. We think there's a better probability to beat than miss, all those kinds of stuff, right? What are the cap rates? What are the rental assumptions? What's our lease up look like? All of that stuff.
Super no, nice. And it takes time. It takes time. I'm always amused when, you know, someone's raising money for a deal, not through your platform, but just in regular. It's like, look, by the time you're going to get someone to actually cut you a check, there had to be a lot of conversations before the here's a deal, give me money, you know, because it's just, there's a level of trust that has to get built. There's a conversation and a process that you got to go to, and it takes time. It's funny for me talking to you about this because in a lot of ways you have it twice as bad in that you have to do it on both sides. You know, you have to vet the sponsors and also answer all the questions the investors have. And so that's a lot. It's interesting. It's interesting. Yeah. No, it's fun talking to you about this, especially because, as discussed, it started with a lot of operators, some of whom were fly by night, and then it dwindled down to the ones who actually seem to be knowing what they're doing. So now that you got the RIA thing up and running, and that's exciting because that's something, frankly, I didn't even wasn't really paying attention to. How do you grow now? I mean, is it just get bigger, or do you think strategically there are other things you're going to grow into?
Yeah, well, for the short term, it's really recover, I would say.
In the post mess that we just came out of.
So yeah.
Me too.
Our annual volume peaked at $1.2 billion in 2021. Still was over $1 billion of equity invested in 2022. And it was well off that, less than 50% of that in 2023.
So yeah, everything slowed down.
First order of business is to essentially kind of like, reboot, recover the marketplace. We, given that for those of us in the industry kind of understood in an environment of raising rates and low transaction volume, there was very little that you could possibly make sense of in 2023, particularly in the latter half of the year. So we had to get comfortable first as a platform saying as a platform that does thrive on volume, transaction volume, kind of activity, both on the investor side, on the sponsor side. It was difficult to understand and kind of get uncomfortable with that we're going to have to be very comfortable for a period of time doing next to nothing. We'll get back to doing stuff again in the future. But we cannot do a deal for the sake of doing a deal. So if it doesn't make sense, we're not going to do it. And that got us down to doing where we had peaked at over 100 deals in a single year, doing literally on average a deal a month in the last.
Right, which is a lot less volume. But at the same time, as you said, it's like if you push stuff out the door that's junk and it blows up on you, the effects are worse than whatever fees you may have generated. Yeah. That conversation is the same conversation you have with people in investment banking. It's the same thing. On one hand, you're raising money for a company. On the other hand, your name's still on the documents. So you can't just be raising money for everyone who walks through the door.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting. It's interesting. So, well, look, sorry.
Oh, yeah. So 24 really is just about, starting to actually get back out there. We are seeing deal flow that is substantially more interesting than it's looked like since, call it the end of 21, beginning of 22, right? I mean, we're, and now we're kind of like, we feel like we're kind of at that beginning of the inflection point of things are actually starting to look better than worse, right? We're starting to see the ability of like the positive leverage in an asset is showing up for the first time again in a number of years. I mean, there's some telltale signs that, that the pricing in the market is starting to look attractive enough to really get back out there. Expansion of cap rates looking interesting, right? Kind of what we would say is market clearing pricing, establishing what we hope will be a new cycle. So that's our plan for 24 is to say there's enough stuff to look at. It's still an inefficient market, still going to be relatively low volume, we think, for at least the first half of the year. We're cautiously optimistic that if we get to a couple of rate cuts in the latter half of the year, that might seem a pickup in transaction volume now that things are going to start to underwrite a little bit better. But that's kind of the thesis for this year. And then to really kind of pick up upon that and get things back up to, over the next couple few years to kind of peak volume again.
Excellent. Well, look, this is good to talk about. I mean, everything you're saying tracks with the conversations I've been having. All the equity people I know in 23 were all saying, well, let's talk in 24. And now that we're in 24, it's like, okay, so we're going to go do some things and the conversations are happening. We're not, it's not trading yet, but yeah, but it's at least people are returning phone calls and being like, let's see about making things happen. Well, this has been incredibly helpful to talk about the not technically crowdfunding, but I maybe crowdfunding adjacent would be a good way of putting it. And I learned something, which is also one of the reasons I do this podcast. So I'd like to believe if I learned something, other people did too. Ian, thanks a lot for your time. Much appreciated.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Josh. Totally.